Thank you, members of the court. Please, the court, my name is Thomas Jacobs. It's my privilege to address you on behalf of the appellant, Tiffany Eimel. Members of the court, this case involves an unreasonable application of federal law, primarily pertaining to the denial of a change of venue in the wake of what was pervasive pretrial publicity in the Tucson-Pima County area. This case involves the murder of an individual named Kurt Eimel in 1999. Mr. Eimel was murdered in July. The case brought to trial initially in July and January of 2001 resulted in an 11-1 vote in favor of conviction, and therefore a mistrial was declared. 5 weeks later, the second trial was held on the heels of that first trial. The trial court ignored the defense effort to advise the court of and have the court take action with regard to inflammatory media coverage resulting in a denial of due process. It should be noted that these trials were close in time. Between the time of January 8, 2001 and February 9th of 2001, and this being the period just before and during the first trial, the media coverage included over 217 television news articles and 23 newspaper stories related to the development of the facts and arguments in the case, that is, the positions of the parties, the actual testimony that the media anticipated would be presented, the day-to-day testimony of the witnesses as it was presented, and a reporting in some detail regarding the details of the mistrial that was declared after the 11-1 vote in favor of conviction. That information that was disseminated included comments from the jury foreman who was interviewed by the media. The jury foreman...
Counsel, you're proceeding on implied or presumptive jury error.
I have arguments for both, Your Honor.
For both. What was the prejudicial nature of the publicity? Much of it was factual, was it not?
Much of it was factual, Your Honor. That is correct.
So, what was the inflammatory, prejudicial, argumentative matter that you're complaining of?
There were several items, Your Honor, and keeping in mind that we are using a totality of the circumstances in making this evaluation, the media repeatedly referred to and characterized Dan Averett, who was the alleged hitman, well, the proven hitman according to the jury in this matter, as the brain-damaged hitman. Initially, they referred to him as the learning-disabled hitman. The media then proceeded to relate that that Mr.
Was that
Averett,
not factual?
It was factual, I guess, to the extent, Your Honor, that he had been in a car accident and had suffered a brain injury. The impression the media was continuing to try to offer was that he was compromised in his ability to refuse the job he was offered by these two ladies, by Teresa Eimel and Michael, who is my client's mother, and Tiffany Eimel, my client. The media went farther than that on that point. They talked about Mr. Averett's family and I believe the fact that his daughter was killed and his mother was injured in the accident, and they went into some depth. This became the state's star witness, Dan Averett. And in fact, there was the testimony of Dan Averett and the testimony of Troy Burling, who was my client's boyfriend, both of whom were present at the time of the murder, although Mr. Averett was the only one who had contact with the victim, was essentially the state's case in this matter, trying to prove a conspiracy that these ladies had gotten together, gotten Averett involved and Bertling involved as their drug dealer to kill Mr. Eimel for insurance money.
I'm still having difficulty grasping what there was that was not factual about the characterization of Mr. Averett by the media.
I guess there are two ways to look at that, Your Honor. It was inflammatory, and it was I don't believe the media said anything that was strictly untrue about Mr. Averitt, but it was presented in an inflammatory, a deliberately inflammatory manner, and that is from which the prejudice arises. I don't believe that the appellant...
And the information was that these two women took advantage of this brain-damaged individual to coerce him to do the killing?
I think that and that they were essentially the brains of the operation, almost literally. And thus
because
placing more
wasn't.
Blame on them. Correct. Exactly, Your Honor. In addition to
Does that differ appreciably from the case that was presented at trial?
The case that was presented at trial did not emphasize Mr. Averitt's lack of a leadership role, in a sense, or his, strictly speaking, the fact that he was brain damaged. It was brought to the jury's attention that he had been in an accident because of the issues that would relate to his cognitive processes and his ability to recall events. So the jury was made aware of that. To the extent that in the day-to-day coverage preceding the second trial and during the first trial, the media, almost on a daily basis, made reference to the brain-damaged hitman was certainly something that that could not or should not have been ignored by the Arizona courts.
Had Averitt pled guilty?
Averitt pled guilty, Bertling pled guilty, and both agreed to testify.
So the state's position was that they were all guilty?
Yes. That is correct.
Well, how is that really inconsistent with the publicity?
Well, the publicity I'm pointing out, Your Honor, is not that they were not in, that they were in cahoots with each other, that this was not a conspiracy. The publicity was that the girls had no contact with the victim and were charged with conspiracy. Their defense was, we didn't conspire to do anything. And the state's position was, yes, you did. In fact, you were in charge. And look at this guy. He's the brain-damaged hitman. They were making their argument based on Averitt's testimony. But with the media attention, the impression that anybody who was listening to that would get is, look, this guy is not a rocket scientist, and beyond that, he's brain damaged. That's what we've heard in the media in 230-plus or 223-plus articles. I think I said 217, actually, and 23 newspaper articles. All of that created an atmosphere where essentially you had a storm of media attention bringing out that fact. And I've just gotten to the first item that I believe was prejudicial to Ms. Eimel, because that was followed up by the hung jury and the jury foreman's comments that my jury didn't do its job and I hope the next jury does, which, when you get to the point where you've had a trial that lasted weeks and you have a second trial within 5 weeks of that, and there just aren't any of these cases that we've cited to you where the two trials have been so close in time. I mean, you look at the Rideau case where it was 4 years apart, and you look at the other cases that were emphasized there. You have cases with retrials, and the courts that have found that there's no effect of the outrageous publicity, in some of those cases they often will emphasize, for example, in the Patton case that's cited by the state on this matter, that's the case they're relying on primarily for the notion that this was factual coverage. In that case, the court noted that part of the problem was not just that it was factual, but that after 4 years, even though some jurors recalled the first trial, it had basically faded from their memories. This was 5 weeks later in the same city, in the same county. And if you look at the jurors at that point who were asked about this, there was a pool of 60, which was on the small side for pools for that type. Although if you looked at Murphy, I believe they had a pool of 78. Of the 60 in the pool, 30 indicated that they had heard the media coverage, that they basically had heard about it or followed the media coverage of the first trial, which was, again, very proximate. Of those, half of them said they couldn't be fair because of the media coverage that they'd heard. Now, that's 25% of the total pool said that because of media coverage they heard about the case, they could not be fair. Now, we have to...
And what happened to those people?
Well, they were dismissed for that reason. But the problem is that when you look at the two arguments, one presumed prejudice and the other actual prejudice. One of the things you look at when you're looking at actual prejudice is percentages. When you're looking at presumed prejudice, you're looking at whether the media coverage was so pervasive and contained so much information that was inflammatory that a fair trial simply could not have been had. And you've got stuff like that where you look at, for example, the the case of Riddell versus Louisiana, you've got a movie of a jailhouse confession was held to be outrageous pretrial publicity. But that's strictly factual, Your Honors. The fact that the individual confessed, and that was introduced at the trial. But just the fact that they made a videotape and broadcast it just three times on the television for people to see was enough for the court to say this was pervasive, and in that community it was unreasonable, and under due process we can't allow that kind of media coverage in a case and let the case go forward in the same community. There were so many options in this case for the trial court to move this to another, even another county would have been sufficient. It wouldn't even have had to been necessarily like Maricopa County, which would have a lot of resources. There's a couple dozen counties they could have moved it to, but they simply didn't do it.
Okay, you are now over your time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Ms. Fletcher, you have a question?
I was going to say there was extensive voir dire, and everybody who was put on the jury said they could simply either they hadn't heard the publicity or they could put it aside.
Yes.
So do we just say the voir dire process is not acceptable?
No, Your Honor, and I know I'm over time. I'll make this very brief. If you look at that kind of analysis, the courts have said that you have to look at essentially how many of the jurors admitted to hearing the coverage, what the coverage was like, and under the totality of the circumstances, whether, given the number of jurors who said they couldn't be fair because of the coverage, whether we really believe that the rest of them could have been.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument. We'll hear for counsel for the state.
Good morning. Riddell versus Louisiana involved a detailed confession by the defendant to bank robbery, kidnapping, and murder, and it was televised to more than two-thirds of the community population. The televised confession left such an indelible impression of petitioner's guilt that it converted the trial that followed to just a hollow formality. The televised confession actually became, in a very real sense, the trial itself. And so it basically upset the subsequent trial into a hollow formality, and this is not what occurred in this case. To prevail on a claim of excessive or inflammatory pretrial publicity, the defendant must show either actual or presumed prejudice. Actual prejudice is actual partiality or hostility that could not be set aside. The defendant does not argue actual prejudice. She has never done so, and she in fact could not do so because each juror who served on her jury assured the trial court of his or her ability to serve impartially. So instead of claiming actual prejudice, the petitioner resorts entirely to a claim of presumed prejudice. Presumed prejudice, however, is found only where there was such a probability of prejudice, notwithstanding the juror's assurances of impartiality, that the proceeding is deemed inherently or fundamentally unfair. The publicity here does not approach that standard. As the Arizona Court of Appeals correctly found, and as this court has recognized in questioning, the news reports at issue were primarily factual, and they basically repeated or summarized the facts that were presented at petitioner's first trial. Even a news report stating that petitioner had hired a brain-damaged hitman to kill her stepfather was essentially true because petitioner and her co-conspirators in fact did hire a mentally retarded person to kill her stepfather. The only news reports that can be arguably characterized as inflammatory were those that issued immediately after petitioner's first trial, resulting in a deadlocked jury.
Well, I take it I've forgotten his name. Let me look. The person who committed the killing, Averett.
Daniel Averett.
He did plead guilty to a criminal offense. Is that correct?
Yes, he did.
So the state did not take the position that he was mentally incompetent or incapable of committing a criminal offense?
Well, there was evidence admitted to the effect that his brain, mental capacities were diminished somewhat due to, I think, a child and injury.
Did the presentation at this defendant's trial take the same line that the publicity is alleged to have taken? That is, this woman and her mother took advantage of somebody who may not have been responsible or capable of understanding what was going on.
I'm sorry, you mean what's the state's position, that they essentially took advantage of him?
Yes. My impression from the argument we just heard from petitioner, from appellant, was that the community was left the impression that Ms. Amell and her mother took advantage of Averett. Is that the same position? Is that the evidence that was put on during the trial of this case?
My recollection was that the evidence of brain damage was admitted more about just on a factual basis. What to the extent to which they took advantage of it, I can't recall at this point.
Okay.
I'm not too sure how much this factors into the analysis, though, because it is still strictly factual.
Well, I guess the argument or the impression that I'm left by petitioner's argument is that the community is inflamed not just by the fact of the killing, but of Ms. Amell and her mother taking advantage of somebody else to accomplish the killing, thereby fanning the flames. And so I pose the question to petitioner's attorney, isn't that the evidence that was submitted? And he suggests, no, not so much, that the state's case at trial did not focus on the taking advantage part as much. So I pose the same question to you.
I don't believe so. They did not make it an emphasis at trial. Even considering that part in the totality of the circumstances, for example, the news report of the brain-damaged hitman and the other specific allegation of inflammatory content relates to the statement that a juror made immediately after the first trial ended in a deadlocked jury, to the effect that he thought the jury had not done its job and he hoped that the next jury would do the job right. That is the only news account that can be characterized as potentially inflammatory. But that was isolated in nature, and it does not demonstrate community saturation with prejudicial or inflammatory content. Further, in questioning and during jury voir dire, only one juror indicated possible exposure to those statements, and he assured the trial court of his ability to serve impartially. There was a six-week time left between the news report that issued here and the commencement of petitioner's second trial. Petitioner does not show extensive coverage during this six-week lap. In Strobel versus California, 343 U.S. 181, the Supreme Court recognized a six-week lasting coverage as counting against a finding of presumed prejudice. Finally, and unsurprisingly, the trial court and the parties had no difficulty in selecting an impartial jury for petitioner's trial. In Irvin versus Dowd, in contrast, it was difficult to find impartial jurors because of the nature and the extent of the inflammatory content, which resulted in almost 90% of the prospective jurors carrying opinions regarding the defendant's guilt. 8 of the 12 who served on the jury thought him guilty at the outset. In Murphy versus Florida, in contrast, the Supreme Court found that excusing 20 out of 78 jurors because of their inability to set aside their opinion, it by no means suggested a community so poisoned against the defendant as to impeach the seated jurors of impartiality. Here, the petitioner's initial jury pool consisted of 120 prospective jurors, approximately a half of which were excused for unrelated reasons. Approximately 40 who were questioned on the issue of pretrial publicity stated that they had been exposed to media accounts of petitioner's case to varying levels. 13 of them expressed doubts about their ability to serve impartially, and they were immediately excused for cause. As in Murphy versus Florida, excusing 13 jurors does not reflect a community so poisoned against the petitioner so as to discard the other jurors' assurances of neutrality, particularly considering the strictly factual nature of the news reports at issue. Petitioner's counsel questioned the prospective jurors extensively regarding their prior exposure and passed the jury panel after moving to strike only one juror for cause on different grounds. That particular juror was eventually removed for the use of a peremptory strike. Now, petitioner makes no claim, has never claimed, that the trial court unreasonably limited her voir dire with respect to pretrial publicity. And so for those reasons, the Arizona courts did not unreasonably apply Supreme Court precedent in rejecting this claim.
Thank you, counsel.
Okay. I have only 1 minute left, so I would like to briefly touch upon the juror misconduct issue, the second certified issue. This issue revolves mostly around one statement that one juror said to another during trial. Apparently, one juror overheard her son say, she had overheard her son say to somebody else that petitioner's trial involved two meth heads who had whacked some dude. This statement did not prejudice petitioner at all. The Arizona Court of Appeals pointed out, number one, when the trial court learned of that comment from the juror, the trial court immediately questioned the juror, and she said that she was not influenced by what she heard her son say. Second, the statement in question was primarily factual, again, because petitioner's case, in fact, did involve a conspiracy of methamphetamine users who had arranged a murder, and evidence to that effect had already been admitted at trial by the time of the statement at issue. Third, the trial court instructed the juror that they were to find the fact based solely on the evidence admitted at trial, and petitioner offered no evidence to show that the jurors failed to heed this admonition. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank both counsel for their helpful arguments. The case just argued is submitted.